You are listening to Workshop Number 8, Digital Photography, delivered by Dan Almendares for Computer Science E1, Understanding Computers and the Internet, at Harvard University's Extension School, on Saturday, November 19, 2005. Visit us on the web at www.fas.harvard.edu/CSCIE1.
Hi, everyone. Welcome to Computer Science E1, Workshop 8, Digital Photography. I am Dan Almendares, and we are actually podcasting this. So if you feel that I'm just such a great orator that you want to hear me over and over again, please feel free to do so. What we are going to be talking about today, as I mentioned, is digital photography. And we have the section notes right over here. And I'm actually going to be talking a lot about some of the basics of photography, and then that way we can go into some of the more advanced topics that we need to discuss, such as even purchasing a camera, getting rid of marketing and such. And then later on we'll also talk about how to share your photos, how to upload them, to use some of the more popular websites that allow you to photo share. So let me start off by saying that digital photography is still photography. It's still photography. So what is photography? Let's go back to the way basics. Well, we can think of it as a way to store and collect light. In this case, for example, film. You might take a photo of something onto a piece of film, and it is recorded and stored on that film as a negative, and then you can print that, and you see the light that was recorded. It's the same thing with digital photography. Between even something as small as a camera phone, to a digital camera that we have here, to a film camera, point and shoot camera that you can purchase, one of those one-time use cameras, fundamentally they do the same thing. They gather, they collect, and they store light. With that in mind, they work fairly similarly. So they both, like I said, they both capture image by light, but the mechanics that they work is also fairly similar. So, for example, they have a viewfinder, where you look into the viewfinder, you see the image, and that is how you frame your photo. Next, they focus light through a lens. Normally, it can't really capture light unless you have a way of focusing it. The lens in our eyes, for example, focus light, otherwise we wouldn't be able to see anything. They allow light to enter to a medium, either to a film in the case of film cameras or to a sensor in the case of digital cameras, and this is allowed by a shutter that opens and closes. In some digital cameras, it's an electronic shutter, but it's still a shutter nonetheless. That's why some of these cameras, such as a camera phone or even just a digital camera, they sound so quiet. They don't have the snap of a film camera that we're used to. That's because they have a shutter, but it's electronic. And it's a little bit different. The differences lie in the details of these steps, not so much in the steps themselves. But since we're so familiar with cameras and the various terminology, it's convenient for us to consider digital photography as a form of photography and use the same terms, adapt the digital photography to use the same terms that we are used to. Although, admittedly, some of these terms are still pretty cryptic. ISO, aperture, f-stop, what does all this mean? We'll go over this stuff, too. So, since a photo is made through light, because of the way that cameras work, there are three main ways that a camera can affect the amount of light that enters in. So, as you may know, if you have a camera with one specific setting, and you take a picture in broad daylight, it may come out great. But then what if you go inside? Or what if you take a photo at night, you take that same picture, it's going to turn out to be really dark. So how do we affect this light? There's three ways that it does it. There's film sensitivity, there's the aperture, and there's the shutter speed. For every camera, this is true. Some of you may or may not know that you can actually take a rather large cardboard box and use that as a camera. It's called a pinhole camera. I encourage you to Google it. You just poke a little hole in one end. In a dark room, you place some film at the opposite end. You put it outside, and you let it sit there for 5, 6 minutes, sometimes a couple hours. You go back. You remove the film in the darkroom, you develop it, and lo and behold, you have an image. Well, that also, like I said before, has some of these features. It focuses light through a lens, although in this case the lens was the little pinhole. But it still has some of these features, such as aperture, the film sensitivity of the film that you entered, and the shutter speed. But what is the shutter speed in this case? Anyone have any ideas? Yeah, how long it was sitting outside. That's the shutter speed in this case. So the shutter may have been your hand, may have uncovered your hand from the pinhole, and then after a few minutes covered it up. It's actually pretty interesting because our eyes also have some of these features. We obviously don't see in images. We see more in fluid motion. So shutter speed isn't really all that applicable. But the aperture, we have our iris. It closes, it opens. And that is essentially the iris of your eye. We also have film sensitivity, the rods and cones in your eyes. You know, as a biology student, I'm really interested in this. And I can describe to you in great detail why the rods and cones are so sensitive. You can take one photon, if you remember back to your physics one from college or high school, that light comes in the form of photons. And our eyes are so sensitive that we can detect one photon of light. And I believe I read somewhere that that is something like the equivalent of if you are on top of a mountain and it was a perfectly clear night, and let's say there was no atmosphere, you could see someone light a match 40 miles away. That's how sensitive your eyes are. And I found it really, really interesting. But for now, I think we'll forego this discussion and go straight into the digital photography. So how are these three related? I think one of the biggest hurdles for everyone who is interested in digital photography is learning these three basic things, the film sensitivity, the aperture, and the shutter speed, how they relate to each other, how they affect your images. Because when you understand this, you will find that you have a great deal of control over your images. The problem is that a lot of these functions are fixed in some of the cheaper cameras. So let's say you purchase one of those one-time use cameras. They only have the shutter. And the film sensitivity is fixed. You bought it at, let's say, ISO 400. You bought an ISO 400 one. The aperture is fixed. The shutter speed is fixed. It's all mechanical. But you can buy SLR, single lens reflex cameras, and you have full control over everything. And you can totally mess up your image if you don't know what you're doing. So film sensitivity. This is how sensitive a film is to light. This is applicable also to digital photography, although it doesn't work in the exact same way. They have mapped the digital technology to use film sensitivity as we know it. So it comes in flavors of, let's say, ISO 100. Some of you may recognize this by going to Walgreens or some other store and you purchase some film. You may get, for example, ISO 100, 200, 400, 800, 1600. Normally, what's commercially available, at least easily, is 1 through 400, ISO 1 through 400. But pay attention to something. It's all doubling in halves. Now, this isn't necessarily because this is a computer science class and we're talking about binary digits and everything's in factors of two. It's just that it's convenient for us to think in doubling and halving of light. So let's take ISO 100. So if we want it to be more sensitive, we might take ISO 200. And that film is twice as sensitive as ISO 100 film. And so similarly, you could say ISO 400 is four times as fast or four times as sensitive as ISO 100. And you may hear me use the terms fast. For example, I just mentioned that ISO 400 is faster than ISO 100. I'm going to explain why we use that terminology. And you know what, to be honest with you, it confused me for months why people say ISO 400 is faster. But hopefully we'll clear it up. Is ISO the same as ISA? Yes. I believe ISA is the official term for ISO. Yes, there's also ASA, which is, ASA is a different form it's a different way of describing the sensitivity of the film, so it has a different setup, so they have different numbers. I just use ISO in this case, because that's what all digital cameras use, or ISO equivalents. ASA, I believe, is kind of antiquated of a term, and so we may not see that quite as much. To be honest, ISO is going to be the easiest thing to understand out of all these three, I think. I'm going to skip aperture for a second and go directly into shutter speed. So you might have shutter speeds in terms of, well, you will have shutter speeds in terms of seconds. So you might have 1/250th of a second, 1/125th, 1/60th, 1/30th, etc. 1/15th, 1/8th, and it goes all the way. But pay attention to this too. This is doubling and halving, mostly. 250, you know, you want to double it, it's 1/125th. Keep in mind that these are fractions. So 1/250th is a pretty small number. And 1/125th is not as small of a number, right? So if we kept going, we have 1/8th, 1/4th, and 1/2. And those are easier for us to keep in mind, that 1/4th is smaller than 1/2, but it's twice as small. But what does this mean? The shutter speed is the length of time that the film or the sensor is exposed to light. And so the longer that the sensor is exposed to light, the more photons it catches and the brighter your image will be. So you might use a really long exposure. For some images, I use 4 minutes of an exposure to expose the sensor with enough time. But for sports, for example, you may want, 1/250th is getting, it's not fast enough. You might want 1/500th, 1/1000th of a second. So to go back to ISO, remember that I was saying that ISO 200, for example, is faster. But let's take, for the sake of example, that we are taking a photo at ISO 100 and 1/8th of a second shutter speed. So how could we represent that separately? We could move up or down the scales and represent the same exposure, letting in the same amount of light into the film. So let's say we double our ISO from 100 to 200. Now we're letting in twice as much light, okay? But if we have the same scene, if there's the same amount of light in the scene, then we can adjust the shutter speed as well to reduce the amount of light being entered and then make the exposure the same. So if we were working in ISO 100 at 1/8th of a second, we then might use ISO 200 and 1/15th of a second. So the reason then that ISO 200 is faster is because it allows us to use a faster shutter speed. 1/15th of a second is faster than 1/8th of a second. And so in this way, a higher ISO, more sensitive film, allows us to have faster shutter speeds. And this is why if you're looking at one of those Kodak Gold Max packages, they say ISO 400 or ISO 800 is good for sports or indoor light. That's because it's more sensitive. And for sports, like I said, you want a pretty fast shutter speed, so you would buy faster film so that you could use faster shutter speeds. ISO 100, however, is not as fast, but it's a little bit higher quality, as I will I'll explain it in a second. I did kind of gloss over that. But ISO 100 is slower, but that also allows you to have a higher quality image in the end. One thing I did fail to mention was that film sensitivity affects the quality of the image. So if you have ISO 100, that's pretty much as good as you're going to get in terms of quality. But let's say you got an ISO 400 film, and I'm not sure how many of you have really played with photography or with film at all, but if you compare two scenes, one at ISO 100 and one at ISO 400, ISO 400 looks really grainy. It's little spots. In film, it's monochromatic grain, but you can see little grain, and that's just because the process that's required for it to become more sensitive is that there's going to be less. How can I explain this? It's not going to be as accurate because it's a little bit faster. It's more sensitive to less light. And this is actually very applicable also in our digital world, where if you increase the ISO on one of these cameras, very quickly you will see it become grainy, very splotchy. It will not look good much at all. And I think I might have, let's see, I might have a sampler too. Okay. So to go back to shutter speed, I mentioned that you can let in more light by having a slower shutter speed. And let's take this image as an example. This is an image. I stuck my camera out the window of a car, supported it by a tripod, and took a fairly long exposure while driving down. Well, I wasn't driving, okay, but my friend was driving, and she let me stick my camera out the car. And here you see streaks of light. And that's because they were passing stoplights also, but street lights. But since the shutter speed, was open this whole time, it was gathering light as this light was moving past. And so that's why it looks streaked. And this actually also happens in images. If you're inside and you're trying to take a photo of someone, if you have too long of a shutter speed, they're going to look blurry because they're moving. And so the light that's captured is the entire movement. And so it's going to be the average of that movement. It's going to look really blurry. It's going to look really bad. So in contrast, yeah, change the lighting to see the pictures. Let's see. Do you know how to do it, Ray? Ray?
Turn that light off?
Do you know how to adjust the lighting?
Sorry.
While Ray is helping us with that, I want to show you what it would look like to have a faster shutter speed. So this is a much faster shutter speed. Here we can now discern details about the road. So now we can see these lines across here, for example. We can see each of the individual lights. And this is because it's a faster shutter speed. It only captures this. So remember, you might be thinking, gosh, okay, how did he take this as opposed to having it look so streaky? Well, I increased the ISO a significant margin so that it is more sensitive to light, and I was able to take this phone, this type of image. And I mentioned that having control over these three topics that manipulate light, the film sensitivity, the aperture, and the shutter speed, allows you to make better pictures. And this is one reason that you could do it, because now you can actively think. You can make a decision about how you want to represent the shot. You're not so clueless about it, so that you have to just take a shot and you say, gosh, it doesn't look how I wanted it to, but you don't know how to fix it. Now you can say, oh, okay, I want it to look streaky. I want it to look like I'm moving really fast. Well, I'll use a lower ISO. It'll increase the length of my shutter speed, and it'll give me that blurry effect that I really like. Aperture is the third way that we can control the exposure of digital cameras and film cameras as well. And this is actually very, well, relatively mathematically rigorous. I'm not going to go into a whole lot of detail, but it is essentially the ratio of the focal length to the diameter of the lens. And it's it might actually be the other way around. No, I believe it's that way. But I think some of you may have noticed, for example, in the Olympics, where you see some photographers on the sidelines and they have these monstrous lenses. They're absolutely huge. But not only are they really long, but they're really fat. They're really far around as well. And that's so that more light can enter in. Think of it perhaps in a way, if you had a bigger window, you're letting in more light, right? And it's similar in fashion. If you have a bigger f-stop, if you have a faster aperture, then you're letting in a lot more light. So I think the window is probably the best way I can describe it for right now, is that if you have a really big window, you're letting in more light. And so your sensor is happier then if you want to let in more light in that way. But it comes in what are called f-stops. And unfortunately, it's not as nice to us as the shutter speed or the ISO have been, because it's not exactly a doubling or halving of the numbers. So we have aperture. It usually starts at 1 and, 1.4. And the reason that these numbers are going to look so strange is because they're a ratio. They're the ratio of, like I said, the diameter of the front element to the lens to the focal length. And so we have aperture 1, we have aperture 1.4, and it keeps going. So we have 2, and now we're getting into some of the more common ones, 2.8, 4, 5.6, 8, 11, 16, 22, etc. Unfortunately, it may look like this is a hectic pattern, or not a pattern at all, except that it goes up. But if you remember that it starts at 1 and 1.4, you can double each. So the doubling of 1 is 2. The doubling of 1.4 is 2.8. Then you go back to 2, double that, it's 4, 2.8 to 5.6. And for each one of these steps, we are actually decreasing the amount of light that's coming in. So an aperture of F1 is letting in a whole lot of light. People say, I think that our eyes, the aperture of our eyes, for example, at full aperture, is probably about F1 or 1.1 or something along those lines. And they do have F1 lenses, but they are big lenses. They are monstrous because they have to have so much glass to let in light. So as we go down this, then we are letting in less light onto the lens onto the sensor, I'm sorry. And this is possible by the aperture. And so just like our iris closes and we can let in less light, so when you go outside and it's really, really sunny, you squint for a little while, but then after a while your iris closes and you're letting in less light. Similar to that, you can actually look in some cameras, and if you decrease the aperture really, really small, you can see that there's a little star pattern that closes. And so that's letting in less light. And so that's how an aperture works. But how does it relate then to ISO and shutter speed? Well, just like that, this comes in stops. A stop is a doubling or a halving of the amount of light entering in. So just like I said, okay, what if we were at ISO 100 and shutter speed of 1/15th? What happens if I bump it up to ISO 200? Well, then I would have to go down to shutter speed 1/30th. Just like that, let's say we were doing ISO 100 at 1/15th of a second and at aperture f2.8. Okay, so what happens if I double the ISO to 200? Well, I can adjust the shutter speed, but I'm happy with my shutter speed. I like the way that the motion looks in the image. It's stopped enough for me, or it's blurry enough as I want it. Well, I can go down to the aperture and say, okay, well, I've doubled the ISO, so now I can make the aperture smaller. So I can go from 2.8 to 4. Because now at 4, since it's a ratio it's basically the ratio of the diameter, you're actually letting in half as much light at F4 than at F2.8. So in this way, you can control very finely the way that your images look and appear. But just like ISO and just like shutter speed have an effect on image quality, so does aperture. And I actually have another example for you here. Just give me a second to bring it up. This is an image of my laptop, and this is actually my class ring on it. When I got a new camera about a year ago, and I was just trying out the focusing instead of doing my work, and that's why I'm at my computer instead of outside. But you can see here that everything's in pretty sharp focus. So, or actually, I need to make sure that this one is the right one. Okay. So, here's an example where I used a really large aperture. I believe I used 1.8. And you can see that the background, look at the background over here, it looks really, really blurry. But over here, this is still in sharp focus. And if I zoomed in really close, then you would see that this is pretty good, but back here, it's, you know, indistinguishable. It's difficult to tell what's going on. But by shutting down the aperture, by making it smaller, there's actually, because of the properties of light and the way that lenses work, it actually causes more things to come in focus. So this is still where I focused, but you can see that it looks sharper further back. And this is an F8 exposure, and so you can see that, yeah, well, even though I had to now use a longer shutter speed, or I had to use a faster film speed to achieve this, I can now see more of what I want to do. And so this is useful because for portraits, for example, you may not want to have the background. You may want to focus in on the person. And so you would use very large aperture, something very big, maybe 2.8 or so. So you can just get the person in focus, and the background just looks very nice and washed out, and you know, it's just a blur of colors. But if you're taking a photo of a scene, let's say I wanted to take a photo here of this class, then I would want to get everyone in focus. So I would use a smaller aperture. I would use f8, f11, f16 to get everyone in focus. But of course, that means that I would have to use a longer shutter speed or a faster film speed, and that can be problematic. But you have to weigh all of these things, take them into consideration when you're taking your photo. So one of the things that I mentioned, that some cameras come with the ability to edit all of these functions. So I have here actually my camera. It's a digital SLR. And some of you may think, gosh, it looks like a regular camera, like a film camera. But it's not. I assure you that there is a digital sensor in here that works based on capturing of light. And it's, you can see there's a little screen right here. But with this camera, then, you can control the aperture of the lens. You can control the shutter speed. You control the ISO. But that is not necessarily true for every camera on the market. So you may... One of my friends bought a digital camera that had a fixed aperture. So that means that he couldn't open it up anymore, or he couldn't make it any smaller. And that was fine for him, but that could cause some creative problems, because I like to be able to have control over the background blur. I want to be able to control how much of the background blur I can use. This, of course, depends on the kind of camera that you buy, but for every camera, like I said, these three things are what is going to affect the end result of your image, how it's really going to look. Let's see, if you really want to learn how to manipulate these three, what I did actually was I bought an old, well, I didn't buy one, but I borrowed an old camera from my grandparents, and they were professional photographers once upon a time, and it was this huge camera. I mean, it was big, it weighed 5 pounds with the lens, it was all metallic, there was nothing electronic about it, everything was manual. And through trial and error, then you start to get a feel of how all of this works, how all of this relates, because this is really kind of complex. And I think that a lot of you may be sitting here wondering, gosh, what on earth did he just talk about? And it is going to be kind of complex. But there are online tutorials also that you can use to get better, to understand better these three things that I just mentioned, the film sensitivity, the aperture, and the shutter speed. Any questions on that so far? Okay, now I'm going to go move away from general photography and move more into digital. So megapixels, we've all heard this term, I'm sure. It refers to the number of pixels that the camera can take, the number of photosites that it has in which it can take an image. But despite what the marketers want you to think, megapixels are not everything. I have a little exercise for you here. I have two images. I have one from a 5-megapixel camera and one from an 8-megapixel camera. And so one of them is, you know, from the 5, the other one is from the 8. Who thinks that this image on the left here of the Charles River 1 January is from the 5-megapixel camera? Okay, so a couple of you. How about this image, the model and the bunny? How many of you think this is from the 5-megapixel camera? Okay, so about the same. Raise their hands. How many of you have no idea? Yeah. Now, you may think, you may like one more than the other, for whatever reason. You may think, well, I don't really like people, so I like this scenery better. So that may be more appealing to you for whatever reason. Or you may just like one for whatever reason. Just one is more appealing. But I'll tell you something, that the megapixels didn't affect the way that you liked either of these images. And that is very true. And having a good image does not necessarily come from a high megapixel camera. There is a there's actually a professional photographer that uses one of these little digital camera point-and-shoot 3-megapixel somethings, and he takes excellent photos, and he sells them for lots and lots of money. He doesn't have to have a camera like this in order to do what he needs for his photography. So the point is that if you know, if you understand the three things that I mentioned to you and you understand how to use them, megapixels is not that big of a deal. Just for your personal edification, the photo on the left here is actually from the 5-megapixel camera. This one is from an 8-megapixel camera. But the point still stands. The quality of the photo is not really affected by it, especially if you're posting online. I mean, it's going to be resized. So, you know, who cares? Who really cares? How about in terms of printing? If you print your picture, will it make a difference? Yes, but I want to touch on that a little bit later because there's more things affecting it. So I have here, then, I'm going to make the marketers cry in their sleep and tell you what actually affects the quality of your photos. So one of the biggest things is actually the lens used, the glass in your lens. If it's just crummy glass, or if it's really good glass with multi-layer coatings for anti-reflective technology, all sorts of stuff, that is really going to make a difference in the quality of your image. And there's various things that can happen from poorly manufactured lens or poorly designed lenses. You can have some sorts of optical distortions. One thing is vignetting, for example, where the corners of an image look darker than the rest of the image. And this is actually a pretty popular style to represent older cameras, and that's because they were not made in such a way so that the light was presented uniformly across the sensor.
What's the word you used?
The word is vignetting, V-I-G-N-E-T-T-I-N-G, and it just means that it's a little bit darker in the corners. And you can definitely, that's only one type of optical distortion. There's all sorts of other ones, and you can even have for two lenses that have the same zoom and, you know, or for the same camera, one can actually be significantly sharper than the other just based on the kind of glass that they used. But, of course, you pay the price in terms of cost. The other thing is the sensor and the electronics and the electronics quality. In this case, bigger is better. So many people say, well, yeah, smaller is good because, you know, you can get good quality. Well, you can get good quality, but really you want a big fat sensor. You even, for film, the bigger the film, you'll get more detail in it. It's the reason that film is higher quality because it's bigger is actually different than that of digital. But the sensor, there's actually two types of sensors in digital cameras. Two of the most popular ones are CMOS sensors and CCD. And there's arguments all over the place saying that one is better than the other. I think most digital cameras now that you buy in the store, most consumer digital cameras are CCD. But cameras such as, well, this one is an example that is a CMOS chip. The differences are not really that obvious, and we'd be getting into a bit technical. If you really wanted to know, you can look it up in one of the glossary sites that I'm going to show you a little bit later. But it's very interesting the way that a sensor works. Let's see. I want to roll this up really quick. My camera is a 20D, Canon 20D. Okay. So just really quickly, I want to talk to you about how a digital camera sensor works. So if we opened up a digital camera, you would find a big chip. Well, not this big, but it would be a certain size, and in cameras such as consumer cameras such as this one, for example, they're actually pretty small. I mean, they're not as big as a 35-millimeter piece of film. And if you had a microscope, you could zoom in really, really close, and you would find that there are a bunch of photosites. So looks like a bunch of pixels. And now, thank you. The thing is, though, is that each one of these pixels doesn't represent every color. So what I mean to say is that each pixel is assigned a certain color. And this is because with modern technology, our sensors are 8-bit monochromatic sensors. So 8-bit monochromatic. So if we go back a couple lectures and remember, that means that we can have 256 different shades of gray. We can only have gray. And I think, gosh, well, look at this image. There's color in it. Why isn't this image gray if these sensors only come in black to white? Well, that's because if you zoom in even closer, you find that it's actually in a mosaic pattern. And I think the most common is R, G, G, B. But what this means is that there is a filter on top of every photosite or on top of every sensor. And it has a specific color, and they're usually aligned in this pattern, R, G, G, B. There's some variations, and there's arguments about which is the best. But using this, a digital camera senses the light, and it will actually reconstruct the image based on the data that it has here. And so they say that, you know, you have an 8 megapixel sensor, but every one of those pixels isn't necessarily a point of light, because the camera extrapolated the information. It's just guessing. It's guessing some of the information that's here. So to make this make a little bit more sense, let's think about each one of these maybe as a bucket. Okay. So let's say we have a whole bunch of buckets, and it starts to rain. Actually, let's make it a mix of rain and snow. Okay, for example. This is going to be an absolutely terrible analogy, but the point that I'm trying to get across is that just like we have a mix of different kinds of precipitation, light comes in different flavors. So we can break up light into the red, the green, and the blue components. So for white light, then all of these exist in the white light. But so let's say that these buckets here can only account for one of these types of precipitation. So we have a filter here. So this filter lets in rain. This filter lets in snow. This filter lets in rain. But we don't know then, if it's raining and snowing, for example, that, you know, if it's different across the range, we don't know at this resolution that it's different, because we can only guess. We only have this much information. We can say, well, okay, between these two, it must be some sort of mix between the rain and the snow. And so for this reason, it's pretty complex, but for this reason, you can have a very high megapixel camera and it can look fuzzy if you look at it at 100%. And it's for this reason, because it's just extrapolating information. There do exist sensors, they're called foveon sensors, that each photosite actually detects the red, the green, and the blue in the same layer. And so you have a photosite, which is for red, and then underneath it you have a photosite that is for green, and underneath it you have a photosite that is blue. And I'm not sure if it might surprise you that if you have a 3-megapixel foveon sensor, you're actually getting a better quality image. You're actually getting more data out of it than even a 5-megapixel sensor in this Bayer kind, or even an 8-megapixel sensor. Foveon, to spell it, it's F-O-V-E-O-N, foveon sensor. These sensors are not very popular. They're in 2 cameras, I think, on the market. All the cameras that if you go to Best Buy and purchase one, they're all in this Bayer pattern, which has the different photosites and then the filters on top of them. But the reason that this can be 3 megapixels and have higher quality than, say, this 5 or 8 is that this is not extrapolating information. At every pixel, it is getting a point of light, and it knows exactly what that point of light is. And so if you look at a foveon sensor, an image from a foveon sensor, it's actually pretty impressive just how sharp it is. And if you compare it to this bare one, now the bare one isn't quite as impressive. And so you can actually scale up this foveon sensor, the image from this foveon sensor, and have it look sharper or even better than this bare sensor. There's actually a bunch of technological drawbacks to the foveon sensor, such as because of the layering, because of the layering, the blue doesn't get quite as much light as the red, and so you can get noise in the form of, you know, some blue noise, and it looks kind of strange. They each have their advantages and disadvantages, but for whatever reason, this has not been developed as quickly as the bear. Bear? B-A-Y-E-R, just like the pharmaceutical company. Okay. But to go back a couple of steps, I mentioned that there were 2 major types of sensors. There's the CCD. I'm going to be talking about Bayer sensors here now because, like I said, most of the cameras are Bayer, so... there's CCD and CMOS. And there's technical differences between the two. It involves the circuits being built into the photosites as it is with CMOS, or being off-site as it is with CCD. But in most cases, you will find a CCD camera. Given the choice between the two, you really can't say, okay, you can't really say, I want to buy one over the other for a specific reason. You just have to look at the overall quality of the camera. But since the electronics on a CMOS system are on the photosites themselves, some argue that it might be a little bit easier to create some higher quality images, or at least to have lower power compared to the CCD. I don't actually know the true validity of these statements, though. So this can affect the quality of your image, then. So like I said, the megapixels don't really matter when you're looking at a camera. It's just about everything else. What really will affect the quality of your images, I think, is practice and, you know, luck. It's just as much luck as it is practice. And some of the images that David showed you were just as much luck for me as they were my knowledge about the way to expose an image. So that's something to keep in mind. Okay. Power on. So, oh yes.
I'm just having a little bit of a hard time following it. Is there anything you can show that how that what you drew there relates to light coming through the camera? Is light passing through those filters and then hitting the gray monochromatic?
Okay, so the question was... Oh, that's fine. The question was how the light passes through the sensor, whether it goes through the filter and then it hits the monochromatic sensors. Yes, it actually does do that. Each sensor has a layer. On the top layer, it's like a little, really tiny micro lens to focus the light into a sharper point right directly over the sensor. And then I think, actually don't know if the filter comes first or if the micro lens comes first, but then there's the filter and the Bayer pattern that I mentioned, and then is the photosite. So then there's the sensor itself. And if you remember, JPEGs are capable of 24-bit color. We had talked about this a little bit in lecture. And that means that each channel, each color, for red, for green, and for blue, allows for 8 bits. And if you remember my comment on the sensors, this is actually really handy because each sensor is only an 8-bit sensor, right? And so that means for each sensor, for each red sensor, for each green sensor, for each blue sensor, there's 8 bits. So we're fully using the 24 bits of a JPEG image. And actually what's pretty interesting is that there actually now exists some sensors that are 10-bit. They're 12-bit sensors even. And they can exceed the color capabilities of a JPEG image. And in these cameras, they have what are called RAW files. You can, they're in some of the more advanced, or at least some of the more expensive cameras. You can save files in the RAW format and actually get more color information out of them. And this can be useful for editing, but I'll go into that a little bit later. So let's say you're in the market for a digital camera. If you're having trouble, consider some things when you're about to purchase one. Consider your abilities. What do you want to use it for? If you want to use it just for some snapshots and you want to carry it around with you all the time, well, maybe you might consider a small camera with a good flash on it or something like that. But if you want to go out and take photos of your kids playing sports, you might need a bigger camera, the bigger lens so that you can zoom in better, so that you can have faster shutter speeds, for example. Also, consider the camera size that you like. They come in all sizes. Here's my phone, and there's a little lens right here. It's really small, but this is certainly a camera. It doesn't take that great images, but it certainly does take images. And then compare it to the size of this lens, for example. This is a much bigger, much heavier camera. They do very different things, but you want to keep that in mind. Do you want to be lugging this around all the time with you? Or are you comfortable with that? If you are, then great. If not, then perhaps you should consider a smaller camera. The next thing to do is come up with a price range. They come in all prices from $100 to $8,000. The $8,000 camera is an amazing camera. I drool over it like every time I see it. But it's obviously out of the question for many of us. It's not affordable. So I believe the median, the average is probably around $300 to $400. You can probably get a great one for $200. Just keep in mind these things that I've mentioned. Do your research for digital cameras. There's lots out there. Here's some good websites. Digital Photography Review, dpreview.com is one. Imaging-resource.com is another. They both have very excellent, very detailed, very in-depth reviews on digital cameras, and actually DP Review helped me when I was considering the purchase of this camera. It helped me make my final decision based on its review. In some of these, you can, I think especially in Imaging Resource, you can search for cameras based on megapixel. I don't really recommend that, because as I just showed you, it doesn't, in the long run, cameras have enough megapixels now where it doesn't really matter. So we had a question earlier about print size versus megapixel. And modern digital cameras have enough pixels to make a 4x5, 5x7, even 8x10 prints. Usually they say about 4 megapixels is what you need for an 8x10 print. If you go to a store, you're going to see 6, 7, 8, 10, 12 megapixel cameras. You're already far exceeding what you need for an 8x10. So you don't really have to worry about that quite so much anymore. Where more megapixels does come in handy, though, is if you like to crop. If you like to crop your images, then you can take, for example, an 8 megapixel image, crop 4 megapixels out, and still have 4 megapixels worth of printing that you can use. So that's certainly one of the ways that megapixels do matter. I don't want to completely discourage you from looking at megapixels. I just want you to realize that it is only one of very many things that can affect the outcome of your digital camera.
Well, the industry does just the opposite, don't they? They always seem to highlight megapixels.
Right, the industry pushes for megapixels, and this is actually kind of funny because, like I said, bigger is better. If going back to the analogy with the buckets, let's say that you want to capture more rain. What are you going to do? You're going to put bigger buckets, right? If you have a very small area of buckets, you're not going to capture quite as much rain. And so for this reason, very small cameras can actually have a problem with light, where they're not as sensitive. And you'll actually get a lot more noise for the same ISO. But, for example, this SLR has a fairly large sensor. It's probably, I don't know, maybe 8 times the area of consumer, I'm actually not sure if it's 8 times. It might be 4 times the area of a consumer lens, of a consumer camera. But that means that it is letting in 4 times more light for the same shutter speed. Does that make sense? Because there's more buckets, so to speak. More buckets collecting more water. So we are now able to get...
sensor size, you're talking about actual physical size.
Right. When I'm talking about sensor size, I'm talking about the actual physical size of the sensor and the actual physical size of the photosites on the sensor. So for that reason, photosites, in general, the bigger the better. You have bigger buckets. You can capture more light. And it's when you're not able to capture very much light that you start getting problems such as noise. The regular consumer cameras are notorious for noise, especially at high ISO, but that's usually because of their size. And when they're packing in more and more and more megapixels, that's nice, but personally, I would prefer lower noise than more megapixels in my images. So I might go maybe instead for a camera that provides less noise for the same price, for example. My camera is an 8-megapixel camera. And 4 is perfectly fine. Mm-hmm. Nothing wrong with that. Is there another question?
Yeah, I'm sorry if this is a dumb question, but can you explain to me how noise manifests itself in a picture?
Okay. Not a dumb question at all. The question was how noise can manifest itself into a picture. So, if you remember, I said that the computer, essentially the computer inside of a digital camera, has to guess some of the color information because it extrapolates from surrounding pixels. And what can happen is if not enough light enters in to one pixel, then it might guess incorrectly. So this is kind of an oversimplification, but let's say we were measuring, let's say we wanted to measure the quantity of water, the rain that was coming down. And, you know, we had different levels of water across our area of our buckets. Well, if we can only measure 255 different things, then we're going to have some degrees of error. But it's also a little bit more than just percent error in this case. Also, it can just be, for example, when you turn up your stereo really loud, you can hear it start to crackle. You can hear it has some noise in the line. That's an artifact of amplification of the noise. Similarly, an artifact of amplification in sensors is more noise in the system, and it's literally noise. And so it looks like differing colors. It looks like color dots that shouldn't be there. Let me see. I might have an example of this as well. Oh, I don't actually, but. It may look more splotchy, because it's just like you turn up the gain on your amplifier. The same thing happens here. It's basically turning up the sensitivity. Yes.
Then does that also affect then the shutter, the delay in the taking of the picture on a digital camera compared to a regular camera?
What do you mean?
Well, when you had a digital camera at one mm-hmm. point, especially in the earlier stages, there was a big delay between pushing the button and mm-hmm. actually getting the picture mm-hmm. Coming in, or whatever way you look at it, coming across into your machine. Does that go along the same line, that the sensors were actually trying to figure out what color or what picture they were seeing, and then putting the image onto your camera?
So the question was whether the properties of these of the sensors cause the shutter delay that's so notorious in digital cameras, and I don't actually think that's true, because just it's as if you know, you turn on a switch, things are going to happen very, very quickly. These sensors can switch between amplifications very, very quickly and very easily, and so that's not necessarily what caused the delay. Usually the delay comes from focusing the lens. So if there's a slow motor, or if it's poorly designed or something, it may take a very long time for it to focus. So that actually brings up a good tip, just a random tip for those of you digital photographer takers. If you can, try to pre-focus your image, because then usually what happens with the delay of a digital camera is not so much the properties of the lens, or the properties of the sensor, or the electronics in the camera. But it's usually the focusing that it's trying to figure out the proper focus before it takes the image. So if you have it focused, then you've already, you're literally removing seconds off of the time that it's going to take the picture.
So you're talking about using automatic focus rather than manual focus?
Automatic versus manual focus is slightly different, because in this case you can use an automatic focus to pre-focus on something, and then you can hold that focus until you're ready to take the picture. And so this is sometimes useful in, let's see, why am I blanking on?
I just don't understand what pre-focus your image
means. Okay, so the question is about pre-focusing an image. It's usually when you hit the shutter button on your camera, it focuses and then it takes the image. What you can do in many cameras is you can have it focus first and then wait. And so that the two are not necessarily connected. And this can be useful if maybe for sports, maybe not so much for sports, but if you focus on somewhere and you wait for the action to come to you, especially for slower cameras, that's maybe what you have to do, then you have it focused, and when they come into focus, then you can just take the image right away and be ready for it. So I hope that was a more clear explanation. Okay. So digital cameras, even simple ones, have lots of dials. What do they all do? There's all sorts of stuff. There's the exposure control, self-timer, there's shooting modes, flash, and I'll talk to you even a little bit about night shooting and RAW versus JPEG. For most digital cameras, you have a good deal of control over them when in regards to the exposure. So the shutter speed, the aperture, and the ISO, you do have a control over in most cases. It's going to be different in every digital camera. I mean, even within the same manufacturer, they can be very, very wildly different controls. Let's see. You have a camera, Canon. So this is a Canon SLR, and we have here also just a Canon consumer camera, and the controls on them vary widely. I mean, they're very, very different. If you look on the top, the dials are on the different place. I mean, the top is basically inverted of itself, and then the back also has very many things. But there's a certain level of commonness between some of them. So if I may borrow your camera for a second. You usually, in most cameras, you usually have a dial on the top, and there's some icons on it, and you turn the dial, and this lets you choose between shooting modes. And actually, these shooting modes are nothing special. Usually they have like a sports mode, a night mode, but if you remember my talk with you before, for sports, what did we want to do? We wanted to increase the ISO. We wanted to increase the ISO and increase the aperture so we can take really fast shutter speeds. Really, really fast. And that's basically what this does. It still keeps it at automatic, but when you choose the sports mode, for example, then it's going to try pushing the ISO higher. It's going to try making the aperture as big as it can so you can have a faster shutter speed. And similarly for night, night mode will usually might pop up the flash and get it ready and increase the ISO in order to take more light in for a night exposure. There's also different ways that a digital camera allows you control over the exposure. So many of them have an aperture priority mode, what's called aperture priority, shutter priority, manual, fully manual. And what these let you do is it lets you tell the camera how much control you want to have over it. So usually what I do most of the time is I actually have it on aperture priority. I have it set to a specific ISO that I know I want. I'll set the aperture, and I'll let the camera decide what shutter speed it wants. Because remember, there's the three variables, the shutter speed, the aperture, and the ISO. It has to pick three of them in order to take the image. And so you can have a level of control over each of these three things. And so with aperture priority, I can control the ISO and the aperture, and it tells me what it wants for the shutter speed. The same thing for shutter priority. You can tell it what shutter speed you want, and it'll choose the aperture given for a specific ISO. Different cameras will have different features. Like I said, there's a couple of things that are pretty useful, such as self-timer. You may think, well, it's a fun little thing that lets me set a camera up somewhere, run, you know, across the way and take a picture of myself. But it's actually more handy than that. Remember when I said that for long exposures, if there's movement in the scene, you will see an average of that movement and it'll look very blurry. What happens then if you're holding a camera and you take a long exposure and you move the camera more than, say, the size of a photosite? Well, that means that light has moved across more than one photosite and you're going to see a motion blur. And so for slow shutter speeds, if you're just hand-holding it, it's going to be a real big blurry mess. And one of the things that you can do is you can set it up on a tripod and think, okay, now I'm on a tripod. Now you hit the shutter button and it's still kind of blurry. Well, what happened was just the force of you pushing on the button has moved the camera enough microns so that it causes a blurriness. Because remember, these photosites are really, really tiny. When you're packing in 8 million pixels into something, you know, the size of a postage stamp or much smaller, this size, we're talking about microns, really, really small length. So if you just move the camera that much in the time that the exposure is taken, you're going to get that much blur in the final image. And so if you put your camera on a tripod and you set the self timer, all the vibrations then that are in the tripod or that happen by you pushing the shutter are gone by the time the self timer goes off. So you can take some really sharp images if you set the self timer on a tripod and just let it do its thing, because it will not move. And that's assuming there's no wind and earthquakes and, you know, all that usual stuff. But using that, you can actually, that's actually one of the ways that you can increase your night shooting. Unfortunately, a lot of the consumer cameras for night shooting, they realize that a lot of people are going to be holding their cameras instead of putting them on a tripod. And so it does the best it can to take a good exposed image at night, but it's not going to be great. If you like to take some night shots, and not even night, dusk, for example, this right here, this image, there is not enough light for me to hold it. I didn't have a tripod with me, but I ended up using the railing on the Harvard Bridge to get it steady enough for this. And so if you have some way of supporting your camera, because when you're using a shutter speed of 1/15th, 1/8th, 1/30th of a second, that's too much time for you to hold the camera really still. So, I mean, you can just be creative. Just hold the camera against a hard surface. And if you push your camera against it, then you're actually decreasing the vibrations in your camera by a great deal. And you can have some very much sharper images, especially in night shots. Because if you take night shots and you don't like the way they look really blurry and fuzzy from the motion blur, try having the people stand still as best they can and try putting the camera against something solid if you don't have a tripod. Ideally, of course, you would use the tripod with the self-timer. But in cases where you don't, just use a wall, use a chair, use whatever you have. Uh-huh.
Is that why the old cameras, people always used to have that little thing that they pushed the old photographers?
Right. The question was, is that why the old photographers had the little bulb to squeeze in?
Right.
Yes, and actually, I have one for my camera because I'm impatient with my camera and I have a little remote instead that lets me sit right next to it and push the button on the remote, and the vibrations are taken by the remote and it do not touch the camera, and so it's perfectly sharp. And but yes, that's why they had the bulb, is to decrease the vibrations in the camera. Okay. Pretty much I wanted this section to be kind of open, because there's a lot of features about digital cameras, and I couldn't possibly go over all of them, but if any of you have any questions, maybe on your own digital cameras, about what a mode does, what a button does, let's go ahead and ask, and let's see if we can talk about any of them. Yeah, I'll talk about that in just a second, about JPEG versus RAW, but just as soon as I ask this question. Yes?
I wanted to ask about digital zoom and optical zoom.
Digital zoom and optical zoom. Oh, that's, yes, I'm very glad you brought that up, actually. Thank you. So going back up to the quality of your photos, digital zoom versus optical zoom is one of the biggest ways you can affect the quality of your image. Do not use digital zoom. Do not. I am dead serious. Okay, so let's say, remember when in lecture when David took that nice image of the mountain and he blew it up and then it looked really pixelated. That's all a digital zoom does, is that it takes more pixels from the, it takes pixels from the center of the sensor and it blows it up to be approximately the same size. But that doesn't work. It's stretched. It's not very good. So you can see some camera and it looks really impressive, 6x optical zoom. It's not giving you anything. It's not giving you, it cannot make data that does not exist. So it's not giving you really any better quality. So, I mean, if you're going to do that, why don't you just crop the image yourself? Blow it up yourself to whatever size you want it. Then you have more control over it. I think digital zoom is just another marketing ploy. Optical zoom, on the other hand, is it's based on, you know, bending the light and the properties of light and lenses, very mathematically rigorous. But because that does not affect the sensor, the same amount of light is reaching the sensor, you actually get much, much higher quality by using an optical zoom. So given the choice, I mean, if on your cameras, if you have, I think on some of them you can turn on and off digital zoom, turn off the digital zoom because you're just, you're doing yourself a disservice by downgrading the quality of your image by, with the digital zoom. I'm kind of adamant about that. I mean, some people will disagree with me, but I think that it's kind of a bad idea.
But then this has a zoom. What is it then? An optical zoom or is it a digital zoom?
So usually most cameras will mention how much optical and how much digital zoom they have
because
on
this
each.
This little button right,
right
here, if you pull it, it
right
will
zoom. So there's a couple of ways that we can tell whether a camera has an optical or digital zoom. If you have a button and you notice that the lens is moving, that's an optical zoom because it's changing the optics. And so we can zoom in and out and you can't see it very well, but there's some cameras that look absolutely ridiculous because they zoom way out, right? But that's an optical zoom. Usually they will mention when you purchase the camera, each kind of zoom. This doesn't really say, but this is a 4x optical zoom and then, oh yeah, it says right here, 14x zoom, optical and digital combined. But it's only a 4x optical zoom, so then that means that it's 3.2 or 3.5 digital zoom. And another way you can tell a zoom is if you look at the cryptic printing on the side of the lens, we actually know what all of these things are now. Because, for example, on here it says 7.2 to 28.8 millimeters and 1:2.0 to 3.0. Let me write this down actually on this. So what this camera says, for example, is 7.2 to 28.8 millimeter and 1:2.0 to 3.0. Oh, I didn't put it on the other line. Oops. So what are we looking at here? We're looking at the focal length, and then we're looking at the aperture. So the focal length, this goes from 7.2 millimeters to 28.8 millimeters. So that is the amount of zoom. If you just divide 28.8 by 7.2, you find that it's 4. So that's how I calculated that it's a 4x optical zoom. It's just by that division. And these numbers here, these look familiar. They're the aperture. It's not exactly the same. You see it's 2.0 to 3.0, but you can have aperture values between the numbers that I have listed here. But this shows you that when the zoom is fully extended, the aperture is smaller, so that there's less light going in. And so this can actually be a problem when you're taking, for example, sports photographs. You may notice that when you zoom all the way in, your shutter speed is slower. And that's really problematic because when you're zoomed in, it takes more effort for you not to make a blurry image. There do exist zoom lenses that have a constant aperture across the range. I rented a $1,000 lens one weekend for some fun, and it was a 70 to 200 millimeter 2.8 constant. It was a beautiful lens, and it had a constant aperture, so when you zoom in, it wasn't any darker than when you zoom out. But that is how you can decode this. The information on a lens is actually really handy. I recommend that you take a look at it and just see, okay, yeah, this is a zoom lens and it has these aperture ranges. If it's not a zoom lens, it will only have one value. So it would be 7.2 millimeters to, say, and an aperture of f2? That is that's a very excellent question. Thank you. Let's see. Any others?
So you want a constant aperture.
So we want a constant aperture. Well, yes and no. In consumer cameras, I think you'd be hard-pressed to find one with a constant aperture. Ideally, you would get a constant aperture lens, but they're more expensive to manufacture. They're much bigger. They're much heavier than their variable aperture cousins. So in that case, it becomes a question of cost. Cost versus effectiveness for what you want to do. A sports photographer might want this constant aperture, but for those of us who are going to take photos of our siblings, of you know, in their soccer games or something, then maybe not so much. Yes.
When you're buying like a telescopic lens, what do you look for? I mean, besides the brand,
okay, when I'm buying a telescopic lens, what am I looking for exactly? Well, a lot of things. First of all, the zoom range that I want. How far in do I want to be able to zoom? What is the focal length? So that, you know, is it really far zoomed in or is it not? I mean, that depends on what you want to do. Nature photographers need huge, huge lenses. Just like the photographers at the Olympics, they need 400 millimeter, 500, 1200 millimeter lenses. Absolutely huge. Usually when you get that big, though, they're not zoom lenses anymore. They're just telescopic lenses. Another thing that you want to keep in mind is if you're a sports photographer, maybe at a football game, you probably want a mid-range zoom, so maybe the 70 to 200 that I mentioned before, and with a constant aperture, because then you can zoom in on the field. So players across the field, you can get closer to. Players closer to you on the field, you can zoom out from, instead of having three, you know, four or five different cameras with different focal length ranges. The last thing to consider is the aperture. If you're going to be taking photos at night, or if you want to have photos where the background is blurred, such as sports photos, when you take a look at a sports photo, you usually only notice the player and not the background so much. The background is kind of blurred out. Then you want to have a bigger aperture, a 2.8 maybe, as opposed to a smaller aperture. So you want to consider what you are trying to achieve with the lens. I mean, it's such an open-ended question that I can't really answer it.
Is there any difference between a Leica and a Zeiss lens?
They say, word on the street is that Leica and Zeiss are two of the highest quality lenses available on the market. Their price shows it, though, and you can't always buy them for your cameras. So, for example, I couldn't buy a Leica or a Zeiss lens, a Carl Zeiss lens for my camera. Some consumer manufacturers actually work with these companies. So Sony, in some of their higher-end models, they actually have a Carl Zeiss lens built in. But some lenses by certain manufacturers are known to be higher or less quality than others. Carl Zeiss and Leica, like I said, are supposed to be at, you know, the cream of the crop, followed closely by Canon and Nikon lenses, and then the other third-party lenses. There's some like Sigma and Tamron that people say are a notch below that even. And to be honest, the price sometimes is, at least more so than in other cases, the price will give you a pretty good indication of the quality of lens that you're getting. It's not always true. There's always exceptions. But if you're buying, you know, really expensive Carl Zeiss lens compared to a kind of cheap Tamron, then you can probably expect that it's going to be higher quality glass, better coatings on the glass, better designed, etc. Yes?
A scenario, if you are to take a still image, image of a still object, with a 2D or 3D, what would you choose? What criteria would you go for? You're not dealing with, you would be in control of lighting, for instance, so that you can light the subject pretty well. So is the number of pixels important in that case, or quality of the lens? What is the most important? And then from there, what would you recommend? What kind of a...
What's the most... Are you asking what's the best quality? Like what?
What criteria would you go for choosing a camera?
Oh, what criteria would I go for when choosing a camera? Oh, given that I'm going to use it in, say, a studio where I can control the light. Well, for example, in a studio, I wouldn't be so concerned maybe with the compactness of a camera. I could go for a bigger camera, maybe more robust and that has a bigger sensor in it. And so, because I would probably likely be using a tripod in a studio, for example, when I have control over it. So some of the things that I would then go for might be sensor size, the size of the sensor, how many megapixels is important. If I'm going to be selling a very high-res image to a stock company, a stock photo company, or to a client, then I want to be able to have more pixels for them to work with. And all of these things are important, but they're not the only, you know, they all mix with each other. And yes, the lens is also a very important decision. You can buy high-quality lenses and you can buy not as high-quality lenses. And some people argue that you can, through digital manipulation and some coercing, you can get a rather cheap lens to act and behave like a very expensive one.
But like you said, if you don't have information, you know, you really can't fudge it.
Right.
There is not enough pixels there to capture
right.
enough information.
Right. Yes, like I said, you can't make data when there's none there. In most cases, for example, increasing the contrast in some of the images, you do need to have a pretty high quality image file. Usually a JPEG will not be enough because there's only 8 bits per color channel. You'll get some what are called posterization effects. Sorry? Right, TIFF. Yeah, TIFF files and RAW files allow for a total of 16 bit per channel. And you can actually achieve a lot better quality in terms of that, in terms of the color information that you can use. So you have more to work with, more colors to work with in your post-processing, if you're processing your photos afterwards. I find your question kind of difficult to answer because there's so many factors that it's difficult to give a general thing, say, yeah, this camera is right for this situation, this camera is right for this situation. It's really just as much personal choice as it is up to the situation itself.
I mean, it's the situation is fixed, right? You have mm-hmm. a studio situation, you have a tripod, you have a light that you can control.
Mm-hmm.
So the things that you have to work for or choose would be how many pixels, how many megapixels you have?
Yeah, so again, back to the studio example, then, yeah, you would choose how many pixels you have. If you needed more pixels, then you might purchase a higher megapixel camera. You might also want to consider how easy it would be for you to be able to transfer the photos. Some cameras allow you to plug them in directly into a TV or into a computer monitor of some kind, and as you're taking the photos, it shows them on the screen, and so you can review them instantly. That might be a feature that you would want to look for in a studio then, because then you can review your images much more quickly than having to plug in the camera into a computer, download the images, and then take a look at them, if that makes sense. So, yes?
If the digital camera is sensitive to light, let's say if you set the ISO the same, is it like with my Canon mm-hmm. Solar, my regular camera, I always put a light on it. So that I can
the flash?
Yeah, flash, yeah. How about with digital?
So the question was if digital is as sensitive as a film camera. And actually, the reason that we have ISO is that it's supposed to give us a standard base of sensitivity. So you can reasonably assume that for 100 ISO across digital cameras and film itself, it's going to be approximately the same sensitivity. There are some cases where some companies actually make their sensors more sensitive than they say, and this can... But that's only a minor variation. But actually, one of the interesting things about digital is that you can actually push up the ISO much, much farther than you can in film and have less grain. For example, I said up here that film ISO of up to 1600 is usually available. There do exist 3200 and 6400 film speeds, but then you're getting into specialty films. But you know what? This camera out of the bat, for example, can support ISO 3200, and then you can even push that further through some effects, there's some special tricks that you can do, and actually push your image up to ISO 12,800. And it's getting really grainy then, but you still have that option. It still is exposing, and it's actually quite surprising if you were to take a piece of film at ISO 1600 and a digital camera, digital SLR at 1600, and compare them. Digital SLR looks clean, looks very clean compared to it.
Yeah, but you would still use like a flash on each.
Well, you need a flash if you're using, in either case, if you're using an ISO and a shutter speed that requires it. So, for example, if I have the ISO low enough on my digital camera, I will need a flash. Because remember that ISO 100 is the same between digital and film. So if you need a flash with film at ISO 100, you will also need it with digital. So. This image is actually ISO 1600. I shoot that fairly regularly indoors because I dislike flash. I much prefer the natural lighting of the room, and that can cause problems because, you know, it still may not be sensitive enough. But it's clean enough where I can take an image and still be pleased with it without having... It's unfortunately kind of dark on here, but if you were to look on one of the screens, it looks much brighter. It doesn't look so noisy. It actually looks surprisingly clean for an ISO 1600, especially if you're familiar with film. You might look at it and say, oh, man, it's cleaner than 400 film, which is true. So, any more questions? Shall I keep going? Okay. So we don't have that much time left, so I'll just go over really quickly JPEG versus RAW. If you remember, I mentioned that JPEG has a max bit depth of 24 bits, so each channel has 8 bits. And that's great, but some sensors have the capability of having more bits, having more information. There's 10, 12-bit sensors. And in order to capture that, you would then take RAW, for example. And then by using a RAW file, what it does is it literally takes the information off of the sensor and it literally writes that information right onto the card. Sometimes there might be some compression to make the file smaller, but it doesn't convert it into a JPEG. It doesn't do anything. It doesn't process it for you. And so a lot of people consider RAW to be the digital version of a negative, because when you download it onto your computer, you have to develop it. You have to figure out how you want to expose it. For example, if you worked in a dark room, you remember you probably remember burning in, for example. You can do that. You can adjust the exposure from a RAW file in ways that you cannot with a JPEG. JPEG is admittedly much easier to deal with because once you take the photo, that's it. It's a JPEG. You can send it to your friends, whatever you want. With a RAW file, you have to download it to your computer and work with it. Usually what I'll do is if I'm spending a lot of time on a scene, if there's a photo that I'm really sure that I've been working at for a while and I want to have the most control over it, I'll take RAW. I'll take it in RAW, and I will take that extra time to process it just the way that I want. If I'm sure that, if I'm taking maybe some sports photographs, for example, and speed of the camera is more important to me then than my ability to go back and post-process, then I might take JPEG. So at least in more expensive cameras, you have the choice between JPEG and RAW. And if you get up to that point, I encourage you to read up more on the differences. But that's just a basic understanding for right now.
Well, yes. How is the processing done? Are you saying taking a digital and putting that onto film?
No. When I mentioned processing, I'm still talking in the digital realm. There are programs that let you import the RAW image, and then you have control over the image, and then you process it into a JPEG. So you... you develop it, quote unquote, as a JPEG.
What's an example of a program?
A program could be Adobe Photoshop.
Oh.
It has a RAW file importer. Some other ones, one that I use is Capture One. There's a whole bunch all over the place. But they actually tend to be kind of expensive. Photoshop, if you remember, is a very expensive program. So, okay. So now you've taken photos. Now what do you do? Well, we spent about an hour and a half talking about how you can take better photos, and that's great, but if you can't take them off your camera, what can you do? Well, there's several options that you have. In my case, I usually just take out my memory card. And on my computer over here, I'll stick the memory card in. I have a little PC card. Actually, it's pretty handy. Looks like this. And you can see that at the bottom here, there's a little slot. And I insert the card into that. And I just put this whole thing into my computer, and it can download images directly. What most users do instead is they will take a USB cable, and they will plug it into the side of their camera, and they'll plug in the other end of the USB cable into their computer. And depending on the software that you use, what should probably happen is that the software will load up and give you the option on what to do with the images. So if you don't mind, I'm just going to take a really quick test image so we can have something to work with. Don't worry, it's not about anyone specifically. Okay. So when you take a digital photograph, it takes the image and it writes it onto your memory card. It's a very basic explanation, but it's important because the memory cards come in different sizes, and you can have memory cards that store more, you can have memory cards that store less, and I actually have a 1 gig card, and I find that I fill it up pretty frequently because the images can actually be quite huge. So I've inserted it into my computer over here, and let's see, I think I will load up iPhoto just temporarily. On Macs, they come with iPhoto, and this allows you to, let's see. Oh, okay. So the question is, how physically did I put it in? I have a little slot on the side of my computer right here, and it just slides right in. Most laptops have this slot. For desktops, you will most likely have to use an adapter where you can plug it in and it has a cable that runs to your USB, or you can plug in the camera directly. Let me just adjust these settings here. Let's see. So on a PC, you might use, there's all sorts of software for both. I'm most familiar with Macs, so I'm going to be demoing some Mac stuff here. So for example, on Macs, you'd use iPhoto. In PC, you might try something like Picasa by Google, which is, I think, better for image manipulation. Photoshop Elements is a kind of a dumbed-down version of the full Adobe Photoshop. PaintShop Pro, you might try all these different things. And sometimes in Windows, you might just instead drag the files into a folder in your Explorer in Windows and just store them that way. There's certainly programs for Windows, but there's a lot, and it would take me a while. So, okay, so here, iPhoto loaded up when I inserted it. It would look the same if I plugged it in with the cable. So don't get confused. The manner is different, but it still reacts the same way. So let's go ahead and import it. Are you sure you want to delete? Well, I don't really like to delete images until I'm absolutely sure that I have a copy on my computer. So I will let it download. And, oh, change the lighting, yes. This image I actually took as a raw file. So it's probably about 12 megabytes or so. It's probably a very large file. And as you can see here, I now have it. Pardon my very old and slow computer. This is just a very quick snapshot. And you can see that we even got Ray over here hiding. But yeah, this is an 8 megapixel camera, and this is fully zoomed in, and you can zoom in more, but let's see, since I took this at ISO 1600, maybe at about here, you can start to see the splotchiness, the noise that occurs, but this is still, if you're used to film, this is very, very clean compared to the noise that you would witness in film. But anyway, let's go back. Let's say I wanted to edit this photo, and it's different for every program, but let's see. Where is this? Okay, adjust. But I can, from here, for example, adjust brightness, contrast, saturation, temperature. Some of these things are not as obvious as others, and I'll just go through all of these, and with the hope that for your own particular program, you'll be able to figure out how to do one of each of these. But it's basically the same thing. It's a different means of doing it, though. So the brightness. This picture I intentionally took kind of dark, so that I could show you that with a raw file, you can actually boost up the brightness quite a bit without losing too much color information. One of the things, if you remember, going back to our analogy on buckets, is that we only have 255, we only have 8 bits worth of information that we can do. So what happens if it rains so much that water starts pouring out of those buckets? Well, we've lost that information. Similarly, what can happen in a digital photograph is what's called clipping. If too much light is hitting it and is hitting a photo site and it's already reached its value, its highest value at 255, there's nothing it can do. It doesn't know what to do, so it's just going to make it pure white. And so if you look up here, we've lost some of the information in this in the very top of the ceiling. But if you look by yourself, you can still see with your eyes on the ceiling, there's still the patterns and the grain on it. So then what we have is called clipping. And if you don't expose it properly, or if you have a scene that's very, very dark and very, very bright, such as this. This is the entrance to a cave where the inside is very dark, but you can see here that the rocks are completely white outside. And that's because there's so much light here that the camera doesn't know what to do with the extra information, so it throws it out. And this, in my opinion, looks really ugly. This looks really bad because you have no detail. Your eye doesn't know what to do with this information. And actually, if you look really closely, we even had a special bonus artifact known as blooming. Let's see. Do you see around this rock? There's a purple cast to it. That's because the light has literally spilled out. The water has spilled over the buckets and into the buckets next to them. And you're getting artifacts in the form of false color. And so one of the things that you want to be careful with is not to overexpose your image. Because if you overexpose your image and you come back and you want to try to get detail out of this, you're not going to. So it's best then to make your exposure correct the first time, or at least a little bit darker if you want to give yourself some leeway. And by doing that over here, I've given myself some leeway. I haven't exposed the entire ceiling. And by going back and making changes, you know, I'm not losing the detail in that ceiling. But anyway, the brightness does just what we would expect. It adjusts the brightness. The contrast, actually, it increases or decreases the dynamic range, so it's kind of a technical explanation, but if you can see the whites get whiter and the darks get darker, it kind of spreads. If you look at the graph at the bottom here, it kind of spreads the graph a little bit as opposed to compressing it. And this graph is actually a histogram. We call this a histogram. Most digital cameras have this function built into them. Usually when you take a photo, you can look at the histogram. And this is really handy. The left side here indicates a value of 0. The right side indicates a value of 255. And the peaks indicate how much of each you have. So here we're looking at, well, we have quite a bit of dark information. And if you look at the photo, yeah, that's true. Look at all these black computers here. And then we have some stuff pretty spread out until just before white when we peak again. And I'll bet you that's up here. So this tells you a lot about an image. And you can actually tell if you're clipping a lot more easily through the histogram. Because look, now we have a big straight line over here in the 255 range. This implies that we are clipping, that we are losing detail because we have overexposed the shot. So keep as opposed to looking at the image after you take a photograph, look at the histogram. I'm dead serious. Don't look at your image. Look at your histogram. You'll get more information from this. You will know whether you've clipped it, whether you've lost information, whether you need to adjust your exposure. This would tell me, gosh, I really need to tone down my exposure. It's way too bright. I'm going to lose information. So I would shift it over and take it again. Since I took a raw file, I do have the extra leeway, as I said, but that is one way that you can improve the quality of your photographs. Saturation actually deals with color, and this actually can be pretty cool if you have if you took a photo that looks really, really bright, has some nice bright colors, and you want to make those colors even more pronounced, you might up the saturation, and you can see that more color appears to be in the scene. Yes?
You can get that just to grab right, even on a consumer camera, right on the camera,
The question is whether you could get a histogram right off a consumer digital camera or not, and yes, most digital cameras have the ability to show you the histogram as soon as you have taken the image. And some even show you a histogram in that preview mode on your screen. You can show a histogram, and it'll show you a live histogram. And that can be really handy for knowing how to expose your image. It's how to access it is different for every camera, so I recommend you read your manual in that case. Now, color temperature, this is something that's unique to raw files because we've taken the raw data off of a camera. We can actually very widely adjust the color temperature. So for those of you who aren't photographers, it's kind of difficult to explain, but I think when you go inside into a fluorescent room, everything feels more green, and when you go outside, it feels much more neutral. That is because the color temperature of the fluorescent lights are actually a lot different. And in digital photographs, you can actually adjust the color temperature, in raw files especially. Usually the digital camera will try to adjust the temperature, detect the temperature of the color and adjust it for you automatically. Usually it does a pretty good job, but if you really want fine control, you can adjust the color temperature. And here you can see now we've made it really red. This might be for some very blue light. And over here we've made it very cyan, for example. Yes, actually, your camera probably does have a setting that says that lets you tell it what kind of light you're in: fluorescent versus incandescent versus shade versus outdoor. Some cameras have that feature, some do not. I find them pointless because setting it to fluorescent temperature doesn't set it to the temperature of these lights, so it can still look a little off. So when in doubt, I still would recommend auto, usually, the automatic setting, because you're more likely to get a more accurate color temperature from your camera. The tint is basically the same thing, except it's for magenta and cyan, I think. I can't remember. There's two. It's basically the same thing as the temperature. The sharpness, if you remember that I said about one of the things about the Bayer sensors is that inherently it's not going to look very sharp. It's going to look kind of fuzzy because it's interpolating the data that it has received. So usually what digital photographers will do is sharpen their images, but not too much, because if you do it too much, you'll actually get some pretty funky artifacts. Let's see if we can do it. Okay, so I've just sharpened it a lot. And I think it'll probably be very difficult for you to tell from there, but around some of these edges, it looks like a little white halo has appeared. I can probably try zooming in on the image to show you, but if you sharpen too much, you're going to get some funky artifacts and no zoom. Okay. So be careful with your sharpness. In Photoshop, you might actually want to pay attention to something called unsharp mask. That's usually what most people, or at least what some people use to sharpen their photographs. There's all sorts of sharpening programs. Depending on the program that you use, they'll have different methods for sharpness. Straighten, well, I mean, that's if you're like me and your left arm does something different from your right arm all the time, you'll get an imbalanced image, and you can use straighten, at least in iPhoto, you can use straighten to figure it out. Exposure, this is actually something very interesting about RAW files, is that if you remember, a RAW file has 10 or 12 bits of information, and most JPEGs have, or all JPEGs only have 8-bit per color channel. So that means you have, you know, 4 bits extra to play with. And with the RAW, there's so much more information that you can even push up the exposure or pull back the exposure and not lose much data. Back to the reference with when this is clipping up here in, with the lights, in some cases it's possible to recover clipped headlights from a RAW file. So if you notice, I still don't have this middle band here, but around it, I've recovered a lot of the data that existed there. And so that is one way that a RAW file can really save your butt. If you have to take an image right away and you can't really concern yourself with the exposure, you can go back and do a lot of manipulations with it. Some other things that are perhaps more useful than these are, for example, the red eye. Usually what most programs will do is you click the little red eye button and then you highlight the area that you want to modify the red eye. So I think I might try it on this little exit sign that's in the far corner. And let's see. So right here it says click the center of each eye. But I mean, I don't really have an image of someone with red eye to try it with. But usually I think what it does is it tries to decrease the amount of red in the immediate area. Cropping is pretty handy. In this case, I really didn't like the way that I framed it. I might want to frame this differently. So, okay, hey. So in this case, I might want to crop it for, let's say the display size. Cropping is definitely something that you should do when you are when there's something in your scene that you don't want to show. Just feel free to crop it. And so now, let's say I was happy with this image, the way that this image came out. How can I give it to my friends? How can I submit it to my friends and show them, you know, the latest things that I've been doing? Well, you have a bunch of choices, actually. You can put them on a CD. You can create a slideshow and put them on a CD. You can make a slideshow and send them over the Internet. Every program, or most of the programs that allow you to work with photos will actually allow you a certain amount of leeway when making a shared thing, or when sharing them. But actually, one of the most interesting things that have been cropping up are online communities of people who are sharing their images. And actually, just a couple days ago, I was procrastinating and I was playing with Flickr. It's not listed here, but I posted some of my images on Flickr, and I found it to be a very neat community of people with digital cameras. Let's see. So here, I've uploaded some of my photos, and it lets me then access them from anywhere that I want, and they're public now, and so I can put a caption with them. And actually, people, it looks like someone has commented on my image here, which is new. So he likes it, which is great. But this is neat because you can search then for other people's images. You can form a community. You can form friends just by this. And so let's say I wanted, like right here, I tagged this with the Charles River. So let's say I wanted to search for it. You know, they have options that allow you to search for other images that are labeled as the Charles River. And so in this way, online communities of images such as Flickr, Flickr is only one example, will allow you to share your photos and look at other people's photos and really, you know, have a sense of community. So here's a bunch of photos of the Charles River. And I just did it fairly easily. And usually for these websites, you can just, Flickr gives you a certain amount of free, bandwidth for you to upload some photos. There's a lot of other ones that exist also, not necessarily so community-based as Flickr. One of them might be PhotoBucket. PBase is usually for professional photographers and such. I gave some other ones over here as well. For those of you, some of you may have seen, especially from the Photoshop workshop, was my website, Mexbox. And while I found that to be nice, I find it much easier to be able to upload my images somewhere instead of having to worry about maintaining a website and having to do it. And so using this, then, it's really easy to share your photos with your friends and with your family. And when you're sharing them like this, let me tell you something, megapixels don't matter because those images were not that big, right? And so I could have a 3-megapixel camera and it can look, you know, if I knew what I was doing and if I made a very nice composition with the proper lighting, you know, my images might look better than, say, a 16-megapixel camera. So that's another way in which megapixels don't really matter. Looks like PhoteKey, PBase, WebShots, these are all some places that you can try. .Mac is for Mac users only. They kind of try to get you to do it. But for those of you who have a Macintosh and were somehow coerced into getting it, then you can certainly share your photos using .Mac. And I think there's even, using iPhoto, there's probably an export to .Mac or something like that. Send a .Mac. Oh. Share. Yeah, .Mac slides, for example. So there's all sorts of ways. So I actually went into a little bit about the extras, such as the color filter arrays, Bayer versus Fovian. I could talk quite a bit more about this stuff, especially regarding optical distortions and aberrations and such. But one place I recommend that you try is dpreview.com's glossary. You don't actually have to write this down. If you just write down DP Review and go to their website, you can click on the gallery link on the left side, or the glossary link, I'm sorry. But this is really handy. This will tell you, again, all of the things that I had just gone over, and probably in a bit more detail, and it'll let you sit down and study it. So if you're interested in learning on how to expose one way versus another, how shutter speed affects aperture and ISO, the sensitivity of the camera, this will probably be a great place for you to go. This also has comparisons between RAW, TIFF files, posterizations, which I mentioned, the sharpening, tonal ranges, everything. So this is, if you're a budding digital photographer, this is probably a place to go. I can go more into optical and electronic distortions and about how they can be affected, but are there any questions before I dive into this? Yes? Oh yeah, if you want, I can post a link to my photos off this workshop website. I'll probably end up posting the Flickr ones since I've been trying that. Yes. So if you wanted to print, what would you do? Some of these online services also have printing abilities. So PhoteKey, for example, you can upload your images, not only share them, but you can print them. One place that I used to use quite a bit was PhotoWorks.com. You upload your files and you say, I want these prints and these sizes, and I even want it on a mug and a mouse pad, and you can order that stuff and get them printed. Some programs allow for easy printing. iPhoto, for example, has an order prints button right there, and it has its own way of ordering prints. Really, the best way to do it would be to find somewhere that you're comfortable with ordering prints from, and what you will do is sign up for an account with them, and upload your photos to them, and then tell them what size you want and how to print it. And they'll usually mail it to you pretty quickly, really quickly. Yes?
Printing your own.
I actually print my own photos. It can be fairly difficult because you have to be very careful with color. A lot of desktop photo printers don't really care about color accuracy, so you print it out and it'll look completely different than it does on your screen. And to be honest, doing color accuracy on between your computer and your printer can be a really big pain. It takes a lot to get color correction exact on every screen and every printer. But given enough patience, time, and money, I definitely think that you can print out prints just as good of a quality, if not more, as that of an external provider. And personally, I prefer to print my own because I have more control. I can print it out. Because sometimes, for example, let's say you have a digital photo that takes a camera that takes a photo in 4x3 aspect, but the print, for example, what's a good one, 8x10, is not exactly the same. So there's going to be some cropping. And the place that you submit your photo to get printed is just going to guess where it's going to get cropped. And so this can be this can be troubling for you if you have some of the most important parts of your image are on the sides. If you're making an interesting composition and you have, you know, a very one-sided image, for example, so in that way you might have more control over printing. But if you're going to print your own, there's some. I definitely recommend inkjet printers over laser printers. Laser printers still do not have it yet in terms of printing out your own photos. But don't be surprised, you can get a great printer for a relatively cheap price and print excellent photos. Yes?
How about the monitor in terms of CRT versus...
Oh, how about the monitor? Yeah, CRT versus LCD debate. So for many years, CRT was the de facto. If you were going to do color accurate work, you had to have very expensive CRT tube and color correct it in this way. LCDs are getting better. For the same price, you cannot get an LCD that is of the quality as a CRT still, I believe. But there do exist expensive LCDs that are very color neutral, that are very close in accuracy to the color. And given the choice, I would buy a CRT, but I don't have that kind of money, so I just use the LCD on my laptop, and I find that it's close enough for me. If you're going to be that picky about it, you probably are taking or have an idea on how to take photos that, you know, can help you afford that sort of thing, because that's really, you're getting really nitpicky then in terms of that. So, yes?
Is there a way to transfer the pictures that you take on your cell phone onto your computer without emailing?
Is there a way to transfer photos from... Yeah, is there a way to transfer photos from your cell phone to your computer? Some cell phones, it depends on the cell phone. My cell phone, for example, has a really, really tiny memory card. If you remember the bulkiness from my last one, this is the one in my camera. It's smaller than the fingernail on my pinky, and it's 128 megabytes. And you can usually have adapters and plug this in to your own computer. Some camera phones also allow you to connect a USB cable to them. It really depends on the camera and how it's stored. And actually, that reminds me, some of these photo sites that I mentioned, I'm not sure which exactly, I know that Flickr does it, is you can actually email, they give you a specific email address, and they say you can email this address at Flickr, and it posts your photo from your camera phone directly onto your Flickr. And it's actually really, really kind of neat. I tried it out a couple of days ago and took a silly little photo and posted it, and it works pretty well. But that's the way that everything is coming together in terms of sharing your photos is really becoming quite interesting. So I hope I answered your question. Yes?
If you use one of these sites, can other people grab your images and do much with them what they will?
If you use one of these sites, can other people grab your images and do what they will? Yes. Because of the way that it works, if you put your image up somewhere and someone wants to download it, they can. I mean, there are some protections that you can use. I think Flickr has some protections that allow you, it puts like a transparent image on top of yours, and so when you're saving, when you right-click an image to save it, right-click and do Save Picture As, then it saves a blank image. There's lots of different ways that websites try to protect your images. But really, if I really just wanted this image, I could just take a screenshot and crop. Unfortunately, it's quite a bit of faith. And what I do is I don't put my original images up. I put a downsized version. So if I'm ever put in a situation where I find, and this has actually happened before, if I find my image is used commercially, then I can go back and say, you do not have the permission to use this. I either want royalty fees or I'm going to sue you. And usually by having the original image, by not distributing that image, you have proof that you are the owner of that image, and you can then win in some sort of copyright infringement fight. And so unfortunately it's an unfortunate side effect, but just like if you made music and sold it on CDs, people are going to distribute it. So any other questions? Yes. Right, so the question was, like, keep my original. What does that mean? Well, in most cases, I still take raw files, so I'll keep the original raw file. I won't put the raw file anywhere else except on my computer and my many backups. But I will convert this raw file into a JPEG, and I'll make it a little bit smaller, and then I'll put that on. Because if you remember, you cannot make data when there is none. If you downsize this image to be about a quarter of the size, you've lost three quarters of the image data. But then also, by posting that, if you still store the original, the full size, on your own computer, then you can say, well, this is the original because, look, it has the data that this does not. And
Where's your stuff ended up?
Where's my stuff ended up? I found a couple of blogs that tried to use it. It was kind of silly. And actually, the way I found that out was through, if you remember a couple lectures ago, David showed us the logs from the Harvard, from the CSCIE1 website. And I actually found it through there, was that people were, I seem to have a spike in this one particular image because he had just directly linked an image instead of linking the website itself. And so, yes?
So the web resolution is 72 dpi, and your images are a lot more when you're taking your much higher resolution.
So print, like you said, yes, is 72 dpi. But most digital cameras try to take photos at 72 dpi anyway. Really, the dpi is just a measurement. I could say that this photo is 3,000 dpi. But that just means that when I print it out, that it's going to be really, really small. But it just has the same amount of information there. It's the same number of dots. It's the same number of pixels that I have here. But the dpi just tells it how much of that information I want to use per square inch, if that makes sense.
Yes.
So, okay.
When you take a picture, putting it on the web, would you go for 72, or would you go for high resolution when you take the picture?
To be honest,
knowing that it will get cropped anyway, you lose it to 72.
So the question is, what DPI do I concern myself with when putting them on the website? And to be honest, I don't pay attention to DPI at all until I print, just because it's not something I really pay attention to, and the size of the image is the size of the image on a computer. If this is a 3,000 by 2,000 pixel large image, if I put that on the web, no matter what the DPI, it's still going to show 3,000 by 2,000. It's only when I print it out that it's going to affect the size of the image. So when I'm posting images on the web, I don't concern myself with the DPI of an image.
Well, actually, just to add to that DPI and the web, the higher the DPI, depending on your connection to the internet, if you have on dial-up compared to like say you're using the T3 line, then the compression of that file will determine how fast you'll see that image on your computer. So if you're in a dialogue tool and you have like 4x6 photo at 300 dpi, then it'll take you hours to look at that image.
Well, that depends ultimately on the size of the image, not necessarily the dpi. If you had an image size of 320 by 240, let's say you had two images, one at 320 by 240 and 300 dpi, the other 320 by 240 at 72 dpi, it's still the same amount of image data in each because the images are the same size or the same pixels across and down. So it would still download at the same speeds in that case. It's only when you print it out that determines how much the DPI comes into play. Sorry?
Because web, you can only see 70 DPI on the web.
Well, no, I don't think that you can only see 72 DPI on the web. You can, because there's, I think what we're getting messed up on is the difference between image size and the DPI, because image size is fixed. If we have a 320 by 240 pixel image, that is how big it is. That is its size on your computer screen. And if you were to assign it an arbitrary DPI, say 300, that only comes into play really when you are printing it out, for the most part. When you print it out, then your computer tells your printer, okay, I have 320 by 240 image at 300 dots per inch. So it's going to put more of those dots into an inch. And so it'll look smaller when you print it out. As opposed to that same image, if you said, again, arbitrarily 72 dpi, it says, okay, I'll only fit 72 dots per inch. So it'll look 3 times bigger, 4 times bigger. But only when you print it out. Okay. Any other questions? Great. Well, thank you for coming. Have a great weekend.